Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.
Do they suggest anything that they think could be used to dissuade Putin from continuing? Like, is it as simple as, well, should we perhaps propose, like, a document that's going to instill confidence that we're not going to ever expand eastward or something of that nature?
Yeah, that's essentially what those types of critics had proposed at the time that I was interviewing him. But now that he has sent military forces in, that closes a lot of doors. I'm not saying that it makes diplomacy impossible, but it makes it a lot more difficult.
Hi, Ken. Can you hear me?
Hey. Yes, I can.
How is it going? Have you managed to get any sleep yesterday?
Christ. A little bit. Is my audio okay?
Your audio is fantastic. I'm going to maybe just let me adjust it on the fly. So say, why don't you give everyone a quick introduction to yourself? That'll be a good time for me to turn the volume up and stuff.
Oh, are we live now? I didn't realize that.
Yes, we are live.
Okay. Well, hi, everyone. I'm Ken Klippenstein. I'm a reporter with The Intercept. I cover a lot of national security stuff, but I do other things like labor and politics coverage, too. I've written a series of stories on the fraying relations between the United States and Saudi Arabia, which I think has a lot of implications for what we're seeing in Ukraine right now. Obviously, the brunt of the coverage is on the military operations on the ground, which is understandable, but there's a lot of other factors at play, and one of them is the role that oil is playing. So when you have Russia invading, they're an OPEC plus member working with all these other member nations to try to control prices. And one of the most interesting things I think that arose from this horrible invasion was this spike in oil prices, an all-time high. It broke over $100 a barrel. Just a couple years ago, it collapsed to like $50 a barrel to give you a sense of how much that price has changed. That gives Putin a lot of leverage in terms of what he can do with respect to foreign policy. And an interesting dynamic here is the role that the Saudis have played. They're essentially working with the Russians to keep prices very high against the requests of the Biden administration to try to increase production to have the effect of lowering prices. And without getting too in the weeds, that's a huge adjustment to the kind of international geopolitical system that we've had. And so in those stories and in this chat, hopefully I can speak to that a little bit and what it's going to mean, because I think you're going to see really striking effects in the domestic political landscape as we move into the midterm elections later this year of the soaring gas prices.
I guess one of the first questions would be is that, I mean, for my understanding is typically that the Saudi Arabia and the United States has a very strong partnership, and that one obviously includes, exchanges of arms as well as fuel. Why then would Saudi Arabia risk something like this?
Yeah, that's exactly why this is so shocking, is that relationship still does exist in the minds of a lot of folks here in Washington. If you talk to the people in the think tanks, they'll tell you all about how important this they call it strategic relationship. That's the sort of euphemism they use for when we work with a government that doesn't have a great human rights record, as the Saudis don't, for beheading people and executing people for things like witchcraft and adultery. They have to try to cast it in a sort of different light, say, oh, it's just strategic in nature. It's beneficial to us in sort of complicated ways that ordinary people don't understand. Now, if you push them, they essentially just say it's the oil. And in a situation like this, where they're working with the Russians and not listening to what the Biden administration has requested them to do, which is increase production so that it could decrease the price of oil, has a dual effect of making the consumer environment a little bit friendlier to consumers generally, both in the U.S. and internationally. But then also that would put some pressure on Putin, because a lot of their income comes from the natural gas sector, of which they are the second biggest contributor in terms of oil production to the OPEC plus nations, Saudi Arabia is the biggest one. So between these two countries now working together increasingly, and I kind of sketch out how that began, and I can speak to that context in a moment. This creates a radically different geopolitical landscape than what we had even just a few years ago. Because as you say, historically, that has been a very close relationship. The perception has been that, you know, they would do what we asked of them in important situations. And indeed, they have. If you look at during the Trump administration in 2018, during sort of similar midterm elections as now, he requested exactly what Biden is requesting and has requested on multiple occasions, which is, again, to increase production to bring down the prices. And the Saudis complied in that request. And then later in 2020, in a different situation, Trump asked them to decrease production to protect the shale industry, which was hurting because of the collapse in demand from the coronavirus pandemic. Saudis again, under Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, complied with Trump's request in the other direction. So they've both increased and decreased production at the request of Trump. Now, Biden comes into office. They haven't done it. You know, he's requested repeatedly, basically since he's come into office, to increase production. I think he has a pretty good case for it, which is that inflation is increasing. You know, the economy is still sort of fragile coming out of the pandemic. And now with what Russia's doing, it makes a lot of sense to ask for that. They're not doing it. So this is a huge change in the nature of that relationship. And I think people in Washington have not adjusted to that reality yet. And I think that's why you're not seeing very much coverage in the media about it, because it's very different than how it has been.
Do you have any ideas to why? Because that is a pretty significant change.
Yeah. So in my story that I published yesterday, I sketch out in 2015 during the Obama administration, I have two officials who were present described to me that MBS was craving engagement with Obama. And recall that at that time, he had not yet done the palace coup. He had not yet seized power. He was the deputy crown prince at that time. So in the context of a, you know, monarchy, literal kingdom, as Saudi Arabia is, having a meeting with the head of state from the most powerful country, your most powerful ally, that can do a lot to shore up your image domestically and to say, hey, look at all this legitimacy I have. If the president's meeting with me, maybe I'm the guy that you should go with instead of the person who was the crown prince at that time. So it made sense that he wanted to meet with him, but he became frustrated and later bitter about the fact that Obama wouldn't do it. I was told that U.S. officials were telling him, we're working on it. We're going to try to, set up this meeting for you. MBS became impatient. He's a young, impetuous ruler, kind of seen as an impulsive guy. And he says, screw it. I'm done with this. I'm going to meet with the president of Russia instead. And then we'll see how the Americans like that. So he meets with Putin at the sidelines of an economic conference in Moscow, I believe, instead of the U.S. And that sends a huge signal about the direction in which he wants to take the country. And so after that happens, Russia, for the first time, is allowed into the OPEC, oil-producing and exporting countries, and is able to coordinate with other member nations of OPEC oil production decisions, which has, again, the effect of determining essentially what the global oil prices are, which is an extremely powerful lever to have in international affairs. And I think you could trace a lot of it back to MBS's leadership and his comparatively, far more, let's say, laissez-faire attitude to working with the Russians, which in the past they hadn't as much. So I would attribute it to, largely to not just that individual, failure of Obama to meet with him, but also the Iran deal. Saudis were very upset about that. And so it's like, and then you have MBS. Biden has famously refused to meet with him because of his role in the assassination of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. And my understanding is MBS is very upset about that as well. And if you look at it, the U.S. has still given him a lot of what he wants. I mean, we're still supporting in various ways the war in Yemen, which has led to the biggest humanitarian crisis in the world, largest number of, biggest cholera outbreak in the modern era, millions and either food insecure or starving. We're still allowing that to go on. So I look at it and, MBS didn't get everything he wanted. Biden's not meeting with him personally, but they got a lot else. So it's sort of shocking to me that they're going around behind Washington's back and working with the Russians, even though, Biden's punishment seems pretty mild compared to what it could be.
Yeah, absolutely. I know when MBS was first being touted as this kind of, reformist, or that he was going to modernize the country and that he was going to bring in like maybe some even progressive values, where people were talking about that kind of stuff in Western media. Do you think that this has anything to do with him perhaps seeing or trying to work outside of uniquely the U.S. sphere of global influence? And do you think as well that by doing what he's done, it actually gave perhaps Putin more confidence to have done what he did?
It absolutely gave Putin more confidence, because it's not just a psychological thing. It's like they are just, the amount of money is staggering in terms of the profits that the Russians are making right now. Again, in 2020, it went below $50 a barrel. Now it's over $100. And bear in mind, when you talk about oil, it's not just the oil, the gasoline that you put in your car. This factors into everything. That not just consumers, but anybody going about their day, oil is factored into any of the goods and services that you buy, because vast majority of them are shipped overseas in tankers that themselves have to use oil. Oil is used for electricity. I mean, I could go on and on. So this has a really profound effect on the modern economy. Putin's revenues are going to double because of the price being that much higher, that gives him a lot of leeway in terms of risks that he's willing to take, expenses that he's willing to incur. So I absolutely think that it is emboldening him. And to answer your other question, I think that it's a conscious move on the part of Saudi Arabia to move closer to Russia. And, when you talk to folks in the intelligence community, they have described this to me as a sort of bad high school relationship, where it's kind of, there's an element of MBS is trying to...
Okay, we are back. Sorry, everybody. I'm not sure what happened. Maybe those of you who said that Putin took us down, not today. We're back here with Ken Klippenstein of The Intercept and discussing his brand new article that just was released as of yesterday or today, Ken.
Yeah, it's just really extraordinary to me. How many times can you think of a close partnership? This is a government that we sell billions in weapons to. We have armed them to the teeth and supported them in this extraordinarily unpopular war in Yemen that, as I said before, resulted in a staggering humanitarian crisis. And how often do you see that the head of a country like that, that's offered this kind of seemingly unconditional support, has his request shot down? We certainly didn't see that with the Trump administration. We're seeing it now. And as I said, it's having a really dire effect in the Ukraine situation, because when you look at a region like Europe, which has very little indigenous natural gas and oil reserves, they are reliant on the international system. And so when they're able to jack up the prices, as the Saudis and the Russians have done in OPEC Plus, that is a huge point of leverage against them being able to respond to what the Russians are doing in a critical fashion. If you look at the way that the Germans had responded over the last couple months, it was very tempered, and that's because they're reliant on Russia and OPEC for oil. And so what the Saudis are doing is just intensifying that problem.
The way you were discussing it behind the scenes, though, and speaking to actual experts in the field, kind of sounded, you were describing it as they were describing it as like a high school-esque, like, is it actually as simplistic as that? Because, I mean, when I watch these kind of world events unfold, I don't think, like, I'm sorry, I may think in my head, yeah, it just seems like, MBS is somehow souring on Biden and he's moving towards Putin, right? But then I'm like, well, in the reality of the situation, it cannot be that reductive. There's got to be something more going on. So why are they describing it that way?
Well, there's obviously a bunch of different factors in any thing that you're talking, whenever you're talking about, international affairs. But when you have a country like Saudi Arabia, it really is a sort of a totalitarian state. I mean, it's not a kingdom in the sense that the United Kingdom is. It's an actual kingdom where the king decrees there's effectively no rule of law. They defer to whatever the king can override the courts. He can override whatever. And in situations like that, I think that personal enmities and these sort of petty grievances that in a more democratic system would be sort of contained, the effect that they have. I think in a totalitarian system, they can have quite a dramatic effect. And I think that's what we're seeing in the case of MBS, who I think is widely, German intelligence way back in 2014 or so warned he was an impetuous and impulsive person who was trying to, prevent him from becoming Crown Prince. And you know, you talk to folks in Washington that know that world. I think it's taken for granted that that's unfortunately how this young 32-year-old leader of the greatest oil reserves in history, that's unfortunately who he is. And because of that, I think that, some of these interpersonal grudges can have an effect that spills out into international policy and has effect on millions of people.
Is this going to be a crucial point for Biden then? Is he going to have to try and repair his relationship with MBS immediately?
Yeah, that's the fear. I think that when you talk to folks again in the national security world, I think that there is a sense of resignation to that Biden eventually is going to have to meet with him. And again, that's not just a symbolic thing. He's not actually king yet. He's not formally king yet. So that means something for him. That means there's a lot of other elites that probably don't like him very much within Saudi Arabia. You have a meeting with the president. That is kind of like the ultimate legitimacy that you can win internationally. And unfortunately, I think that a lot of people inside believe that that's inevitable, that it's going to have to happen. Because as I said before, I mean, you can look at any amount of political science literature. There's so much evidence for the dramatic effect that gas prices can have on electoral voter behavior. People think that it's very unlikely because of that, that Biden's not going to eventually cave. So I think that unfortunately that probably will be what will happen, but it hasn't yet.
I know most of the analysis from the left and the progressives when it came to this issue not even from the left, but there has been a very large contingent of people who know way more about this than I do, saying that like the actual invasion of Ukraine by Putin just wouldn't make sense, both from an economic and a geopolitical standpoint. And yet here we are in the midst of this conversation. Both what you've discovered, I guess, with the relationship with Saudi Arabia and does any of it seem to make more sense to you now based on those discoveries, or is it still something in which when we're trying to understand what is taking place, where do we, like, I don't like the liberal idea of positioning Putin as a cartoon character, right? Like, he's just doing what he's doing because he's evil. So usually I try to look at it from like, well, what exactly is the purpose behind this? But in this case, it seems to be something that is both enormously unpopular right now globally, as well as there's now protests taking place in Russia. This could definitely threaten potential much larger scale wars if he invades NATO, right? Like, what exactly would the purpose be behind what he's doing, and how much does what you research play into that?
Well, I think it's really complicated. I don't, purport to say that the dynamic that I'm describing is the only factor here, but I think it's a major one, which is that, if Putin and the Russian government had planned to do something like this, and you're not really sure when you want to do it, probably the best time to do it is when oil is at over $100 a gallon. That's going to give you, again, the freest hand to be able to absorb some of the costs associated with it, both diplomatic and economic. So I imagine that plays a pretty significant role. But another thing, because I talked to a lot of folks in the intelligence community about this, because I had the same question you did, which is I looked at this and I thought, wow, this would be a crazy thing for him to do because he's going to have to deal with an insurgency. It's going to be really ugly, rightly, internationally. People are going to be upset about it. So I was asking people, trying to get their sense of it. And the segments of the intelligence world that seemed to think that it was going to happen even before the intelligence assessments were coming out more recently were folks that told me that Westerners don't appreciate the extent of the perceived political grievances on the part of not just Putin, but Russians generally in the context of NATO's expansion eastward. These folks described to me an attitude within the Kremlin, still angry over stuff that happened in the 1980s under H.W. Bush. Originally there was an agreement not to move NATO to the east of Germany. And some of these guys within the U.S., very not, probably don't agree with me politically. They're closer to the center or the right. Mm-hmm. Even they are sort of, it's not like they, they were very pro-America, very patriotic, want to win, but they look at that conflict and say, yeah, maybe we should look at a sort of diplomatic solution in that regard and try to respond to some of that frustration. I think that in their estimation of that problem being a very serious sticking point for the Russians, I think they were right in that estimation. And I think that it was sort of underappreciated by Westerners how significant of a sort of political object the NATO expansion eastward was, because, you know, someone like me, I look at that, I say, well, this was before I was born. Like, how? Yeah. You know what I mean? But that's not, for whatever reason, that's not how the Kremlin sees it. And I think there are people in the in the U.S. government that understand that, but you don't hear that point discussed very much, because it's very easy then to, you know, you're defending, I'm not defending the Russians. It's bad to invade a country. Duh. That's obvious. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think it should, I would, of course I would rather it not happen, but they're saying when you're looking at the toolbox of options we have to how to respond in a way that could try to improve the situation, that seems to be what a lot of people point to, short of military confrontation, which I think anyone sensible agrees is extremely risky and something that you should try to avoid.
Yeah, absolutely. Do those same people, it doesn't have to be them specifically, but do they suggest anything that they think could be used to dissuade Putin from continuing? Like, is it as simple as, well, should we perhaps propose like a document that's going to instill confidence that we're not going to ever expand eastward, or something of that nature?
Yeah, that's essentially what those types of critics had proposed at the time that I was interviewing him. But now that he has sent military forces in, that closes a lot of doors. I'm not saying that it makes diplomacy impossible, but it makes it a lot more difficult than it was before, because there had been a sort of arrangement called Minsk II, under which he was supposed to respect the independence of these territories within Ukraine that had broken away from the Kiev government. And now that he's violated that makes it a lot harder. The thing is, you know, even if diplomacy is still quite difficult, I don't see what options we have. It's extremely dangerous. And again, folks in the Pentagon will tell you this, maybe not the people that get invited on TV, but they understand that any direct engagement between two nuclear superpowers is extraordinarily dangerous. And if you look at other conflicts, for example, Syria, things in the Middle East, there's a process called deconfliction where the US and the Russians are sharing with each other intelligence about where their sorties are flying. They deconflict. It's to avoid what I'm describing, avoid the two superpowers from bumping up against each other, because it's
even in a proxy war.
Yes, even in a proxy war. Not because we like the Russians or because the Russians like us, but because they realize that if you don't do that, things can very quickly spin out of control. And unfortunately, I think that's something that we, you know, need to be concerned about in the situation in Ukraine.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's one of the reasons why when you look at the map itself, you realize, and especially with, you know, now Biden bolstering up NATO nations, just how close everything is getting in the proximity of it. I think there's becoming too much room for human error added to that. But anyway, sorry, I don't want to trouble you with these doomsday scenarios. More interesting to me, this morning when the Russian markets opened up, the Moscow Stock Exchange, they had the single largest dip, I believe, before they ended up stopping trading at 45%. Do you know how much of that is related to either the sanctions that are being imposed, and also how does this play into now the new relationship with Saudi Arabia that Russia has fostered?
Yeah, so finances are so complicated. And again, I'm describing one facet of it. I don't want people to think that I'm giving them a comprehensive picture, but I think that the oil profits are going to offset, or they've judged that the oil profits they're enjoying now are going to offset the cost and pain imposed upon them by these sanctions.
Even Germany cutting off the pipeline.
Yeah. So something that's not really discussed in Western media, and I think people kind of loathe to say, is that the West and NATO, they're kind of hampered in terms of how much they can do, because the more pain they inflict on Russian financial institutions, there are studies indicating that that is going to have a sort of splash effect on neighboring countries, on other countries, again, because of the role that Russian oil, the second, you know, biggest OPEC plus member, has on the global oil supply. So it's really difficult and I think probably impossible to design sanctions in such a way that they will, you know, inflict pain on the Russian government and not end up hurting not just everyone internationally, but our European partners in particular, who are dependent on that oil to a degree that I don't think we are, or many other countries are. Mm-hmm.
And what are the ramifications then going to be? Like, because when the when the drop happened, one of the first things that I saw a lot of people saying, especially online, was that, like, oh, it seems the sanctions are working. This is going to, you know, everything from this is going to turn the Russian people against Putin, or, you know, the inner circle and the oligarchs who reside there. They're going to be taking massive hits. So there's definitely a strong message being sent in the opposite direction. But it would seem that you've kind of set up a scenario in which they are going to be somewhat insulated from the external pressure of that.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I would warn against this kind of fatalist attitude that sanctions, like the South Park joke, sanctions are equal this, equal Putin's out. Like, I would remind people how many times, you know, U.S. officials have said that sanctions are going to oust, for example, the Iranian leadership. They're going to oust the Houthi leadership. They're going to oust, you know, Kim Jong-un in North Korea. I can't think of a single example, or they're going to oust Saddam Hussein. I don't know that there's an example in history where that's come to pass, because sadly, and I'm not saying that we shouldn't, you know, punish try to disincentivize Putin from violating international laws he's done in Ukraine. But when you look at sanctions as a tool, they have a very poor track record. They have a good track record of harming ordinary people, because unfortunately the elites in these countries tend to be very adept at evading these things and structuring their lives such that the people that absorb most of the pain are going to be ordinary people and not the folks at the top, just because by dint of the fact that they have all the power in those countries, particularly in authoritarian countries. So I would be very skeptical of the notion, not that it won't hurt or potentially, you know, deter him, but this idea that it's going to have a really, you know, decisive effect on anything.
Would that leave one of the only potential diplomatic solutions that you see being something like a Minsk II agreement? Like, is that the closest?
I think Minsk II is dead at this point, but certainly some kind of discussion about the, you know, the limits or boundaries of NATO expansion could be something, you know, and perhaps in exchange for the Russians withdrawing from Ukraine or whatever it may be. I think something like that is really the only constructive way forward, whatever you think of Putin. I just don't see any other solution.
Is this going to bring renewed criticism, or maybe even more criticism, of America's relationship with Saudi Arabia at this point, do you think?
Again, Saudis are very insulated, as I was saying off camera, in that they have a very effective, them and the other Gulf monarchies, the oil-rich Gulf monarchies, have a very effective public relations apparatus in Washington. You have guys going on MSNBC, going on cable news, talking about human rights, and they're getting paid by these, you know, horrible dictatorships, frankly, you know, kingdoms, dictatorships, where human rights are a joke. You know, it's not something these governments respect, and they're getting paid $1 million a year, you know, hundreds of thousands a year. A lot of media contributors have these kind of relationships. People leaving government are hesitant. I mean, when I do this kind of reporting, one of the most difficult things in my experience is to get people to critique these regimes, because it's so common for them to go on, leave, and enjoy some kind of you know, contracting job or consulting gig. So for all those reasons, I think it's going to be an uphill battle. And that's why I've been trying to draw attention to this stuff. I think it's unlikely that the mainstream is going to pay a lot of attention to it.
Do you think in the upcoming, like, there's no way of predicting what's going to happen in the next 24 to 48 hours, since everything seems somewhat unpredictable. But do you think there's going to be renewed scrutiny perhaps into either these relationships that you're establishing, or the new ones that are being, I guess, formed with Russia? Since, I mean, you're one of the first people to break this story, right?
The resiliency of these relationships has always astonished me. I mean, you know, there is circumstantial evidence for that, you know, segments of Saudi Arabia were involved in 9/11. Mm-hmm. And I would think that would be something that is going to be a bit of a political hamper on working closely with them, but apparently not. Apparently it doesn't matter. So, you know, with that as my context, I come into this a little bit pessimistic about the likelihood, you know, not that we necessarily have to, like, you know, punish them or go to war with them or anything like that, but that we're going to hold them to account in any sort of way or withdraw our support or withdraw what seems to be a almost, you know, unconditional support for these governments. I'm a little bit skeptical of it. But that being said, the situation is so dire that, you know, Biden's in a really tight spot. If, you know, I would say that if there was ever going to be a confrontation between these governments to try to reset the nature of the relationship, the next couple of years are probably going to be it.
Are you aware of if any of the targets, either through sanctions or the targeting of oligarchs, if those have gone after some of the larger ones who have investments in America?
I mean, when you're getting to the level of, you know, global oligarchs, their money is so international, you know, and capital has become so frictionless now that, you know, they can move and evade things so easily. So I don't know that those old distinctions mean as much anymore in the age of Bitcoin, where you can move money around instantaneously and you know, have investments all over the world with minimal. I mean, we haven't had, you know, strong regulations on that kind of thing, on the international flow of capital, since the Bretton Woods system. Again, what I'm describing to you, if you talk to sanctions experts, sanctions is so complicated because they have to get around these kind of problems. And I have to be honest with you, I don't know how likely it is that you can. I mean, it's a really difficult problem. I don't know that Biden's necessarily doing anything wrong. It's just really hard to design sanctions in such a way that they hurt the people in charge and minimize the harm to not just ordinary people within those countries, but ordinary people internationally.
From your own analysis, what do you, and you if you're like, I'd rather not comment on that, you don't have to, but I'm curious, what do you think were the motivations for Putin to have accelerated things this far? Is it simply just NATO, or do you think there could be something else from a geopolitical standpoint or a strategic standpoint that he's looking to gain, maybe leverage in order to bargain for things like you know, oil contracts, stuff of that nature?
Well, that's what's so strange about that, is that Ukraine is not, in sort of financial terms, an enormously valuable asset to have in one sort of international portfolio. So that leads me to think that a lot of this is perhaps historic grievance, perceived grievance about NATO. But again, these things are so complicated, and it's not just Putin. There's other oligarchs involved in these kind of decisions. So I'm really just speculating, but I would guess that the primary one is that you know, tension with the West that exists.
What's do you know anything about what's going on in Chernobyl right now? Just out of curiosity.
No, I don't. I know very little about what's on the ground because I've been paying so much, like, kind of on the sort of tactical side of this, just because I've been paying so much attention to the financial side.
Okay, well then maybe I'll ask you this from the financial side: how bad is this going to impact Germany now that is effectively deciding to, you know, stall the pipeline?
I would imagine it's going to be, you know, devastating to not just their economy, but the center left government that just won against the AfD, a far right, you know, with seemingly authoritarian movement with strange views on race. And I think it's very concerning, and not just them, but all of those countries. It's very concerning. Again, I'm not saying that, you know, we shouldn't disincentivize Putin, but I worry that we're being a little bit glib about the effect on the global financial system that you know, significant sanctions can have.
Can you expand on that? Just out of curiosity, because you're saying that different countries in Europe could stand to maybe
I said before, they don't have indigenous. They largely don't have indigenous oil, so they're really relying on the OPEC system. And I mean, even the U.S. is, and we have a significant domestic apparatus now with natural gas fracking. But it's very serious. And I mean, you know, macroeconomics, you're getting into la-la land. It's so complicated. So I'm not going to pretend to know what will happen. But, you know, these are very serious shocks to a fragile system coming out of the coronavirus pandemic.
Yeah. Oh, man. Okay. So in the past, I guess, couple of days, I've completely forgotten about the coronavirus pandemic, the trucker uprising in Canada. They all seem like years away. but I guess that also plays into, do you think from a U.S. perspective, is the focus of the United States now going to be almost like this is a international crisis, the likes of which none of us have experienced in our lifetime kind of thing? We need to focus directly on this. Or do you think there is going to be now both a U.S. concern on this as well as dealing with the ongoing, you know, devastation in the United States that's coming from COVID?
It's a very novel conflict, at least in my lifetime, in the sense that again, we are up against another superpower. A lot of the wars and conflicts that we've fought over the last 20 years or so have been what's called asymmetric in nature, which is that we're a huge superpower and a state against non-state actors like Al-Qaeda or ISIS or, you know, Al-Shabaab, whatever it may be. That's a very different kind of conflict to fight than when you're fighting another superpower, as Russia is. And in some ways, it can be far more dangerous because of the, you know, tools that they have at their disposal.
How does the, I guess, relationship with both Russia, Saudi Arabia, and now this new one that you found play into the larger conversation about the climate crisis, which I guess is probably the most existential threat facing humanity, but one that, you know, is probably going to be dwarfed now by war?
Right. Well, Biden, in a town hall event, I think for CNN a few months ago, was talking about exactly the stuff we're talking about, which is how do I deal with the Saudi Arabia problem? And he kind of hinted that the tension that exists, their refusal to increase production, was because I don't want to meet with a certain someone. You can guess who he's talking about, MBS. Mm-hmm. And so in that discussion, they kind of asked him, so what's the solution to all this? Kind of what you're asking. And he says, we have to get off oil. There's no other solution. And, you know, I can criticize the president for not doing more to hasten that transition, but I think I agree with him on that point. I think any solution we're looking at is going to be sort of tinkering around the edges until we bring about that transition. I don't see any other long-term solution that gets at the root of the problem.
Do you know in what way that could take shape, though? Because it seems to be an ambitious statement, right? And of one which I agree with you. I would totally agree with it. But is there like a concerned push then to maybe even looking at climate change now from a like a wartime perspective, as in this could prevent further conflict? Yeah. Might be a good
angle. I would say this. People always bring up these questions. How do we do this? And I notice nobody asks, how do we do this when Elon Musk wants to go off into space for a joyride or whatever it is? No one asks, how are we going to somehow we find
or tinker with monkeys?
You know what I mean? So it's like, well, maybe we can bring that level of sort of lunatic vision to something that could actually help people.
Probably the best suggestion I've ever heard. We need to Elon Musk this, but just not for ridiculous shit that doesn't help anyone.
Right, we can clearly do big visionary stuff. It's just that we're only letting the oligarchs do it. I mean, let's do it. And we have in the past. If you look at how quickly, I could give you any number of examples. The interstate highway system, how quickly did we bring that up? The oil system itself, this was brought into existence very rapidly, which shows that, you know, if you are able to leverage enough, you know, political power, you were able to do these things that seem incredible. It's just so I really don't buy that line that it's like, oh, it's too hard, we can't do it. I mean, maybe politically it's too hard, but not in any sort of absolute terms.
One question I want to ask you, and this one might be a little bit contentious, but I just saw a poll recently that says 26% of Americans would be in favor of direct conflict with Russia, including American troops. And I don't know how representational that is of, you know, polls can be polls and how they work. Right. Questions can obviously change a lot of things. But that number was higher than I suspected it was going to be. What would your opinion be of, you know, the public opinion, I guess, of America perhaps moving more towards being okay with that concept, or do you think it is something in which in this day and age everyone is kind of, we've got a larger understanding of the implications, especially the global implications of such a conflict between these two superpowers?
Well, I guess you can look at that poll two ways. 26% is concerning, but also that's pretty low. And I imagine the economic, this is why it's so important to have countries to have countries engage in trade with each other and to have relationships, and not just to, as we've done with Iran, just block all interaction. Because the more intertwined they are economically, the harder it is to get in these sorts of conflicts, to get in these wars, because it has a greater economic effect on both respective countries. And that's one of the few things to be sort of hopeful about with regard to China, because there's so much domestic capital in China that is exported to us, that could end up preventing a hot war, or maybe not even just a hot war, but makes it harder to get into into direct conflict with them. And unfortunately, China does not have that kind of an economic system that is as close. I mean, other than oil, obviously, that is closely entwined with the rest of the West. So I would be concerned about that. But I mean, this is all happening so fast. I'd like to wait a little while to see when the dust settles and what people's opinions are and things.
You're right about that. It's like almost every sentence we say by the time we're done speaking is probably out of date, and then something new has happened. Do you have any thoughts on what China's role will be in this? Because they've kind of taken a stance.
Well, that's very interesting. Yeah, so they had a very high profile meeting, Putin and I think Xi, a couple weeks prior to this. And if you look at how Putin moved his forces, he moved them away from the southern border with China for the first time, which suggests that, I don't know this for a fact, but it suggests that there was some kind of discussion between them, an agreement that, if we move our troops here, you're not going to cause any problems. We can use them in Ukraine. So I wouldn't be surprised if there was some level of coordination between the two on this. And that's very concerning to, the NATO member parties and the rest of the West, because China has a lot of, assets that Russia does not. I mean, Russia has a, very advanced military and a lot of experience in using that military, but they don't have the sort of manufacturing power that China does and financial power that China does. Most of Russia's economy is the oil sector, as far as I know. So that partnership could really dramatically change the balance of power internationally, and I fear could lead to something like Cold War. But it's all so new, we don't really know yet. They haven't worked closely together much in the past.
Well, one of the last things I wanted to ask you about is the Russiagate, which I seem to remember was dominating the news around the era of Trump. And now we're finding, as soon as this event has unfolded, I've, a bunch of different reporters, I'm not going to name names because I'm not here to start drama with you, but they're effectively coming out now and saying this may not have happened under Trump, for example, because Trump had a better working relationship with Putin, and he didn't have any what appeared to be, imperial goals as strongly as he does now. How do you think all of that plays into this? And are you upset about the resistance gloating?
I think that that sort of picture of Trump is like pro-Russia. There's certainly evidence for, but this is almost like on the level of cable news. It's so superficial. Like, yes, Trump has said insane things and done insane, like saying, Putin's a genius to move into Ukraine. It's insane. It's a crazy thing to say. That being said, you have to look at what the policies were during the Trump administration. And there were some very escalatory things that he did with respect to Russia, particularly with regard to, nuclear posture. And I can't remember exactly what it was, but he changed some proliferation agreement in the direction of, a lot more hostile, a lot more confrontational, something that Russia really wouldn't want. Now, that's not to say that Trump is anti-Russia or whatever. I'm just saying it's complicated, and these sort of discussions, these very superficial discussions of, he tweeted this or he said that, therefore that indicates that's not how it works. Like, he's got guys in the NSC he's picking that don't necessarily think how he thinks. I mean, he had John Bolton in there, for God's sake. And, and I can't think of somebody that more embodies the kind of neocon rhetoric rhetoric purported to oppose. So these things are not monoliths. The Trump administration was not equal to Donald Trump's tweets. And I wish the media would cover these things with a little bit more thoughtfulness so people could understand these things, because that's just not how it works.
Or hold him to account for his statements. Would be nice as well. when you mentioned nuclear, potential use of nukes, do you think the language that Putin is doing, he's using that as a deterrent? Because I've also heard that used quite a bit. Some of his phrasing yesterday obviously was very strong, like anyone who, would oppose this will meet a response they've never encountered, or something to that effect, right? Very Nixonian style language, or hearken to Kissinger. I was curious if you think that is like a veiled threat or something.
Oh, totally. Okay. You'll see. Over the years, he, when he wants something, he'll say, like, Russia is a very serious nuclear power. You can't push us around. And that's definitely what he's doing. Now anyone who would use nuclear weapons in a first strike capacity would be suicidal, because they will be annihilated in response, or, any actor, targeting another nuclear power anyways. So, but that's not to say that we shouldn't worry about it, because, I mean, this is exactly what I was talking about before. You put two superpowers in close proximity to each other in confrontation. You know, humans are not perfect. Accidents can happen. Misunderstandings can happen. You can look at something on a radar screen and it seems like something that it isn't, and you make a mistake. All these things are very, very concerning and get short shrift in the sort of superficial, I think, cable news style coverage of these kind of things. And I should say, people in Russia understand these things too, and I'm sure there are people in Russia that are worried about exactly what I'm describing.
Do you think, because like you're saying, the people in Russia are concerned, and we're seeing these massive protests happening today, that there could actually be a large enough uprising or pushback from the people or from the anti-war sentiment in that country to actually affect Putin's thinking? Or does he not?
I just don't know. I'm not going to pretend to understand Russian domestic attitudes. These things are so complicated, and it's all filtered to me by media that probably has a broadly Western orientation like I do. So I think it's really hard to know, especially in an authoritarian country like that, where it's probably hard to measure opinion and things.
Do you think mutually assured destruction is still going to be a guiding compass and principle?
We wouldn't have nuclear weapons if it wasn't. Mm-hmm. Definitely. I mean, that's what everyone in NUCOM, and I'm sure everyone in the National Security Council, that's the framework that they view the world through.
I guess one last thing I want to ask you about this article that you just put out on this relationship. Do you think it is going to be some kind of a blueprint for the future engagement that both world players are going to do in terms of their interaction? Like, are we going to see suddenly China have to bolster a very strong relationship with Saudi Arabia? Will Saudi Arabia play off multiple countries? Are they always going to be looking out for their own self-interest? Doesn't matter who their ally is, kind of situation?
Well, every state is looking out for its own self-interest, but the way in which that state's leadership is configured helps determine how they perceive their self-interest, and you know, that's, and I think that's why a lot of people thought that Putin would invade, because it seems to go, I mean, it's such a risky endeavor. It's so, as you said, unpopular internationally. There's the potential for a widespread insurgency within the country. It could end up becoming something like his Afghanistan or something. You know, just to say nothing of just all the you know, other complications.
That would be Russia's second Afghanistan.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Right. Yeah, exactly. It all comes back. But I just wish the coverage was a little bit more thoughtful. It's all, everything gets flattened, you know, like I was saying before about Trump, everything gets flattened. Like, what did he tweet? And it's like, or it treats countries as monoliths. I mean, they're so, you know, there are people, there are different segments within the elites in any country. It's all very complicated. I think that's what people are sort of waking up to in this conflict. It's really hard to know what is going to happen when decisions are not made by one person, as is the case in all foreign affairs.
I completely agree with you. I think that's one of the problems with the way people report on these things, even specifically to like the United States. Like, I will speak out consistently about the American empire, about the military industrial complex and stuff like that. But like, I also don't want harm to come to Americans specifically, the same way I don't want them to happen to Russians or Ukrainians, right? Like, it's obviously, even if they have authoritarian governments that I completely disagree with, it's unfortunately the people on the ground who are going to suffer the most, as always.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
Ken, I can't thank you enough. I know this must be like your busiest time. It's like peak news in the midst of all this. And
oh, my pleasure. Yeah. I followed you guys for years. It's nice to finally get to chat with you.
And once again, we can prove everybody in chat who keeps saying that they're seeing double. And I was like, we're in the same room, everybody. So you can't say that we're the same person anymore. This is not a trick. You're not watching magic in the, there's no delay. Oh, by the way, where can they find you, Ken, before you take off?
Oh, yeah, just hit me up on Twitter. And if you're a federal government official, I've got my signal in my Twitter bio. And shoot me a message.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
All right, bye, guys. Take care.
That was the incredible Ken Klippenstein here to tell us about the world, the news, and please go check out his new article. He just put it out on The Intercept. It is a fascinating read if you want to learn a little bit more about the relationship between Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, and now Russia. It seems like a lot of the things that I used to talk about back in the day would be like around the Bush era, like neocon days. It's like, well, House of Bush, House of Saud, you can see how deeply intertwined both the United States is with Saudi Arabia, even though, you know, we do have some of the hijackers of 9/11 being from Saudi Arabia. But anyways, this is a relationship that is going to be an everlasting friendship. And now we've gotten to the point where Saudi Arabia is forging new friendships with Vladimir Putin. So it's a hell of a time. It's a hell of a time to be alive.
Do you enjoy the surfs but prefer not to have to use your eyeballs? Many are saying this. Well, we've got the solution for you. It's the Surf Times in podcast form, available on most major podcasting networks now. If you enjoy it, please consider leaving a good review and feedback, because it really helps the show out, apparently, and it's free, just like the podcast.
To our gods, Xander Corvus and Peyton L. Just, we beseech thee to smite down our enemies. To our monarch, Tom Spiker, we are but your humble court jesters, here to amuse you. To our lords, Trevor R., we give thanks for this spit of land for us to eke out this meager existence. To our knights, Merid, Cheryl Alvarez, Ruby Kelly, Ellie Leslie, Alex P., Brandon, Words Greenwood, Nate, that one guy, Hagbird Celine, Matthew Scarborough, Stellar Vision, Ariane McCarthy, Daniel Sutton, Coulter Smith, Val 9000, Jenna Tall, Quiet 185, Anna Loves Riley, Omni, Riley and Anna, Poodlehawk, The Tim Caucus, Multi Mondi, Trevor Yanis, Lemmy 101, Anthropofojack, Saren 42, Catherine, Radical Maniac, Ramon Acosta, Nkosin, Violent Orchard, Sophie Baby, Political Puppy, Andreas Chiringuito, Zach Christensen, Josh Mickelson, Todd Buckingham, and Todd Lajeunesse. We raise our flag in a veil, and we salute you, our friends.
Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.